Be to Acts chapter 25. As we continue thinking about what Richard just sang about, that act of God through Jesus to reconcile us to God, we see that becoming the focus of Paul's trial as he stands before King Agrippa. Moves from Festus to King Agrippa in the text. So if you follow along with me as I read Acts chapter 25, verse 13. There we go. Acts chapter 25, verse 13. And when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a man left prisoner by Felix, but when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And when the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. And then Agrippa said to Festus, "I would like to hear the man myself tomorrow," said he. "You will hear him." So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in, and Festus said, "King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I might have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him." So as we continue walking through Paul's trial, we have some new characters that surface. We have King Agrippa and Bernice that come into view. And so it's good for us maybe to start there and just wrap our minds around who they are. There he is. That's King Agrippa. That's Herod Agrippa II, right? His great-grandfather was Herod the Great. And when you think of Herod the Great, you should think about the man, the king, who was alive and ruling during the life of Jesus. That was Herod the Great. We heard about his father, Herod Agrippa I. So Herod the Great is the great-grandpa, right, of Herod Agrippa II. Herod Agrippa I is his dad. And we heard about him already in Acts chapter 12. Verse number 1 reads this way: "About that time, Herod the king," that's Herod Agrippa I, "laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also." So that's Herod Agrippa I, his dad, who ultimately started some persecution of the Christians there in Jerusalem. And we're also reminded of Herod Agrippa I's death, his dad's death. Acts chapter 12, verse 21. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes, took a seat upon the throne, and delivered an oration to them. And the people were shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory. And he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. So that was Herod Agrippa I's father. And at that time, when that was occurring, this man, Herod Agrippa II, was being educated in Rome at the court of Claudius. He was 17 at the time of his father's death. The holdings of his father were given to his uncle, also called Herod. Y1TB. And he managed the affairs until Herod Agrippa II was old enough to rule on his own. In this case, the ripe old age of 21, which everybody should be made king at 21. Amen. So he enters into his heritage at that time. His rule never extended to the length or the extent of his great-grandfather, Herod the Great. Particularly, he never ruled over the main Jewish territory of Judea, of Samaria, of Galilee. Herod the Great did, but Herod Agrippa I did not, and Herod Agrippa II did not. Festus is in charge of those regions. So here's Festus in charge of Jerusalem and Samaria, Judea, and yet here comes King Herod. Why is he called King Herod if he's not even in charge? Why is he even there, right? Well, one of the reasons was he was an Edomite. He was a descendant of Esau, and because of that, he had Jewish blood. And so they viewed it as if he had some sort of right to the throne. But also, he was given by the Roman government to be in charge of the ceremonial vestments worn by the high priest on the Day of Atonement, which was actually quite a big deal. And in addition to that, he held the authority to appoint the high priest, which is an even bigger deal. And so here is King Agrippa II, who ultimately, to the Jews, was as close to a king as they had. He was a very important figure from that standpoint. That's King Agrippa. Who was Bernice? There we go. There's Bernice, quite the hairdo, right? Bernice was the sister of Herod Agrippa II. You say, wait, what? That's what a lot of people said in those days. She was a year younger than Herod Agrippa. She had been married at the ripe old age of 13. And she was given in marriage to her uncle, Herod. Her uncle, Herod. which would obviously have been her father's brother. Things transgressed not well in that regard. The historians are unified in describing her as a great beauty. Her husband slash uncle died in AD 48. Her brother Herod was granted rule. Herod Agrippa II was granted all of his estates. And so she moved in with him. He was a year older. And so now you have Herod Agrippa II and Bernice. So when we see in verse 13, now when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea. This is brother and sister, but there were already rampant rumors of a sexual relationship between the two of them. And it wasn't long before she actually married another king, King Ptolemy of Cilicia, but she did not live with him very long. She actually went with her brother in the early 70s to Rome, and she became the mistress of Titus. Titus was the emperor's son, and that caused a major scandal. Titus wanted to marry her, but because she was a Jew, she was Jewish, she was a Jewess, she wasn't socially acceptable. So when Titus became Roman emperor in AD 79, he was forced to abandon his relationship with her. I say, why do I care about any of this? Well, number one, to catch the context of what we're talking about. Number two, to understand some of the real issues that were swirling about at this time. Because there's some ironies that we can point out here. But we would ask the question, why are they involved? Okay, if we know this about King Agrippa II and Bernice, why are they involved? Well, from the standpoint of Festus, they're involved because he still doesn't know what to do. In fact, we read that, verse 26 and 27 of Acts 25, where it says there, I have nothing definite to write to my Lord about him, that he has a problem. Paul had appealed to Caesar, and that solved the current issue. But there's a future problem. Festus does not want to waste Caesar's time. Nobody wants to waste Caesar's time. Because if you waste Caesar's time, then you suffer the consequences. And so he wants to make certain that he has a good reason to send Paul to Rome. And he's not certain how to do that. How can he solve that dilemma? From the standpoint of Luke, he is explaining how Paul got to Rome. And part of that pathway is through King Agrippa and through Bernice from that standpoint. He's also fulfilling the words of Jesus. Acts chapter 9, verse 15, the Lord had told Paul, go, or he'd actually told the guy who's going to go talk to Paul, what was his name? Led him to the Lord, was it?
Ananias,
thank you. He had told him, go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings and children of Israel. And so fulfilling some of those words, we find him brought before King Agrippa as well. But what I want us to do is to just understand some of the ironies of this all. So let's consider some of these ironies. Here's the first irony. The guilty is judging the innocent. So can you imagine this? Here is Herod Agrippa II, who is involved in an incestuous relationship with his sister, Bernice, and they show up and they're going to stand in judgment over Paul. Paul has already been demonstrated to be innocent, and they are as guilty as sin, and they're the ones who are standing in judgment. How ironic. How ironic. We have injustice that produces justice, because it's the injustice of Festus keeping Paul in prison that serves the justice of keeping Paul alive. Because remember what the plan was? That if Paul would be brought down to Jerusalem, then they would ambush him on the way and kill him. And so it was an injustice that Festus continues to keep him in prison, but it actually ends up serving justice by keeping him alive, that the greater injustice would have happened. We see a third irony. The third irony is that the pagans follow God's law more than God's covenant nation. And what a heartbreaking irony this is. Because here you see that Rome is more interested in being just than God's covenant people who are supposed to be following the law. It's like, how could this be? But then we also see Paul's deliverance ends in Paul's death. Now, we don't see this directly yet, but ultimately what Paul sees as the way out, and really, from a human standpoint, it is the only way out. He appeals to Caesar, but it ultimately results in that being the end of his earthly life. But then this final irony is what we want to focus on this morning, and that's that the trivial exchanges places with the important. That when we begin to think about what is actually significant, what is actually important, we find it swapping places here. We see this ironic twist in verse number 18. Look with me there. Acts chapter 25, verse number 18. It says, when the accuser stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion, about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. You know, that was actually the most significant thing that had ever come across the eyes or ears of Festus. And he entirely missed it. He entirely missed it. On December 17th, 1903, Orville and Wilbur Wright finally succeeded in keeping their homemade airplane in the air for 59 seconds. 852 feet it was in the air, right, at Kitty Hawk. And they rushed a telegram to their sister in Dayton, Ohio, telling of their accomplishment. It read this. Here's the telegram. First sustained flight today, 59 seconds. Hope to be home by Christmas. The sister was so excited that she rushed to the newspaper office and gave the telegram to the editor. And the next morning, the headline stated, quote, popular local bicycle merchants to be home for the holidays, end quote. The editor missed the scoop of the century because he missed the point. He just entirely missed the point. Sometimes we miss the point because we lack a perspective of history. From our vantage point in history, it seems inconceivable that anybody could overlook that first airplane flight and focus instead on a trip home for the holidays. Who cares if the Wright brothers are coming home for the holidays? That was one of the most significant events in the history of the world, you could probably say, an event that changed so much about what the world looks like now. But at the time, he didn't realize it. And incredibly, you know, in spite of the vantage point of 2,000 years of history, there are many people today who miss the significance of the resurrection. That they still fail to grasp how important that is. What a crucial difference that has made. And as believers, we need to be certain that we don't miss it. And so what should we do? We should remind ourselves of its importance. There are really two views of the resurrection. And the question that I want to put to you is very simple, and I doubt that I would have anybody who would respond wrongly to the question, but it's important for us to meditate on it and to think about it. And here's the question: which view of the resurrection do you hold? Here's the first view. The resurrection is insignificant. It's insignificant. Perhaps this is you. I doubt it, but perhaps this is you, that you view the resurrection as an insignificant event. But perhaps this is the perspective of someone that you know. And we can learn much from Festus as we consider his perspective of the resurrection. If you're a believer, it's against this type of thinking that we should be on guard. And we begin to see this type of thinking in the life of Festus and others like him. He thought the resurrection is insignificant because he was nearsighted. You know, when a person is unable to bring into proper focus things which are far away, they're described as being nearsighted, right? So such a person has no problem seeing a clear distinction between the things that are close to themselves. But the farther away something is, the more blurry it becomes. I'm nearsighted. I wear contact lenses to correct my nearsightedness. And it's always a bit amazing to me when you get into the chair at the eye doctor's office and you put your eyeball up to that machine and you look to the far and you're trying to make out, is that a P or is that an F? Because I'm pretty sure it's one of them. But I can't quite see if that thing is closed or not, right? And then they flip that lens over, and it's so clear. And it's like, oh, it was an R all along. No, I'm just kidding. it jumps out at you, right? And if you're nearsighted, then everything up close is clear. But this is what's happening from the viewpoint of Festus. He sees what's in front of him really well. And from that standpoint, he has a clear focus on himself. What's Festus's focus? His question is, how do I get out of this jam? He says that he's interested in justice, but is he really interested in justice, or is he interested in appearing just? Because ultimately, when he has to choose between justice and what looks to be the better situation for himself, he throws justice away and he chooses what looks like the best situation for himself. So you remember that horns of dilemma that he was on? He recognizes Paul is innocent, but he also knows that the Jews want to kill him. And he says, I want to please the Jews, but I probably shouldn't kill a Roman citizen who's innocent, by the way. And so when Paul jumps to the excluded middle, and Paul ultimately says, hey, why don't I appeal to Caesar? He says, yeah, let me jump on that. But now he realizes that he really doesn't want Caesar upset with him for wasting his time. That if he sends Paul to Caesar, and Caesar's like, why are you sending him to me? And he says, well, he's innocent. Well, that's not good. Why didn't you let him go? He says, well, because the Jews wanted to kill him. That's not good. Because he says, if I needed somebody to govern the locals, I should assign them there, shouldn't I? What are you doing, Festus? Well, I should be governing the locals. Well, why don't you do that and not have me do your job? Well, that's a real problem for Festus, right? Because he wants to demonstrate that he's competent in handling these local issues. And if that's all that this is, then why is he sending Paul to Caesar? But the biggest problem here is that these things seem so big that he's not able to lift his eyes up and see farther what really should contain his focus. Because that larger question is right in front of him. I mean, it's really mind-boggling, isn't it? To put yourself into the position of Festus, he is so consumed with these local politics and his own life that he has missed the fact that God took on flesh, died on the cross for the sins of mankind, and then rose from the dead. And it's like, man, if I could have been alive during that time, if you could have been alive during that time, would you have recognized the significance of that? Would you have been one who would have said, like Paul, this is the most important event in all mankind? Or would you be like Festus, which is like, yeah, they're squabbling about something, but I need to focus on what's important to me. How do I solve this problem? You know, there is coming a day when the reality for Festus was going to stare him in the face, and he was going to have an answer for what he did with Jesus. And I think what happens many times is that the resurrection seems nearsighted because we get, resurrection seems insignificant because we get nearsighted. That we get so focused on some of the small things that surround us. And I just encourage you, start thinking about what some of those small things might be in your life in light of the resurrection. Because what that does is it gives us a tremendous amount of valuable perspective, that we're able to take that giant step backwards and gain God's perspective and go, you know what? This issue, which seems so massive to me right now, means nothing in light of eternity. And the resurrection then begins to give us power to address the issues that are in front of us today. It doesn't like fill us with this kind of like weird, mystical, you know, nerve-shaping power. It's more the concept that what it does is it helps us to have that perspective of what is actually important. The resurrection is insignificant when I am nearsighted, but the resurrection is insignificant also when I'm distracted. Look at verse number 23. So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Can you imagine what that was like? We get a sense of the importance, don't we? It's a big event, a lot of pomp and circumstance. Yet the truth is, it's really not that important. That truthfully, it's a distraction. All of the pageantry surrounding the visit of Herod Agrippa II and Bernice, I mean, it was nothing more than a distraction. It was unimportant. It might have looked impressive. It might have looked spectacular. But the real story of the day was what Paul had to say in front of them when he talked about the resurrection. You know, in the book club, we're currently reading Daniel Brown's book called The Boys in the Boat. And it's a story of 9 young men who won gold in the 1936 Olympic Games. They actually rode in front of Adolf Hitler in Berlin, and they won the gold medal. I'm not to the end of the book, but I'm pretty sure that's how it's going to end. The story is focused upon one boy in particular. His name is Joe Rance. And Joe had an unbelievable, difficult life, truly shocking. And the things he endured were quite remarkable. And as the story moves along, one of the things that the author impresses upon his readers is the need for single-minded focus when the boys are in the boat. And he's setting the stage as he's talking through the story about how Joe struggled with rowing, not from a lack of physical ability, but from a lack of mental ability. In fact, one of the rowing chants was M-I-B. And you can just imagine rowing. M-I-B, M-I-B, M-I-B. You say, what does that mean? It was mind in the boat. Mind in the boat. And so over and over again as they're rowing, that was the idea. Keep your mind in the boat. And that was one of Joe's big problems. And all of the difficult and challenging events that swirled around his life were constantly pulling him away from the boat. And he'd lose focus, and then he'd row poorly. And one of those distractions was the terrible relationship he had with his father. For good reason. But it was a terrible relationship. And during one important race, they're in the middle of a championship race, and they're approaching a place in the water where Joe could see the home of his father at that time, a home at which he was not allowed to live. And he was in the midst of rowing and staying focused, M-I-B, M-I-B, And the author starts to talk about how he thought, I should be able to see my dad's place now. And I think I said out loud, don't look, Joe. Don't look, Joe. Because if he's rowing and his mind's in the boat and he looks, and what happens? It's going to be a disaster. They're going to lose the race. Well, he didn't look. They won that race because he didn't get distracted. You know, when we think about the distractions that surround us, they keep us from focusing on the things that are actually important. And so here's Festus. Here's Herod Agrippa II, who get distracted by looking at things that look big and grand and important. And certainly it would seem that way. When you look at verse 23, the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp. They entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Boy, everything looks like that's the focus. That's the big deal. And there's all kinds of those things that might distract us away from what the really big deal is. And friends, we can get very real about this, right? Because ultimately, all of your accomplishments at work look nothing more than like that. All of your accomplishments in society are nothing more than that. All of the things that ultimately this world longs for someone to look at and say, now that's a successful person, when you compare that up to the resurrection, and it's like, it's nothing. That's nothing. It's inconsequential. And it's just easy for us to get that inverted, isn't it? And to say that the resurrection happened, but it's not a huge deal, but this right here is a massive deal in my life. And it's like, no, that isn't the case. The truth is, the resurrection is a massive deal. That's the big deal. And so I would ask the question, what are the things in this life that distract you? And we could actually ask that question then to others, what are the things that I could point out in others' life in a way to point them towards the resurrection? That might distract them. I need one more before I move on. The resurrection is insignificant when I'm selective. Verse 20 says, being at loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. Why was Festus at a loss as how to investigate the question? Because it appeared to him to be a matter of private opinion. How is a person going to determine whether it is true? So he was looking at the resurrection. He was saying it's not factual. In fact, that word that Festus uses in verse 20, literally, you could translate it this way, doubting about these speculations. So the idea there is that it's superstition. Now, I don't think he's looking to be offensive, but as he's talking to Agrippa, he's saying there's all of these superstitions, these speculations, and I don't really know how to address those because they aren't factual. It's clear that Festus understands Paul's view on the resurrection as dwelling in the realm of faith or belief, not in the realm of reason, as if those are two entirely different things. But friends, they're not. I'm arguing that an open mind is crucial to following Christ. And I've had people try to challenge me on the level of saying, listen, Steve, you need to have an open mind to other possibilities. And it's like, no, actually, you need an open mind. I have an open mind. Because I'm willing to look at not just what science says, but what everything says, and what everything says is that there is a God, and that he did send a son, and that he did die on the cross, and that he did rise from the dead. And that is what everything says. That's not just a narrow-minded view that says, well, I have to discount that, and I have to discount that, and that's just a matter of opinion. That isn't the case. An open mind is truly what genuine believers embrace. Here's the picture. That sometimes science takes on this level of worship, where people look at reason and say, well, that actually is fact. And I would debate them. Because science has much to do with faith. You know, 50 years ago when he was a student at Cambridge, John Lennox found himself seated next to a Nobel Prize winner at a formal dinner. And he decided to make the most of his opportunity. So he asked the Nobel laureate if and how his scientific work had shaped his worldview, including his opinion on the existence of God. Well, I'd love to sit there and listen to that conversation, right? The conversation didn't go well. The gentleman made it clear he wasn't comfortable with Lennox's questions. Not only that, he asked to speak with Lennox privately, and when he asked Lennox if he really wanted a career in science, and he said, yeah, I want a career in science. He says, well then, this Nobel laureate winner, right? He says, you must give up this childish faith in God. If you do not, it'll cripple you intellectually, and you will suffer by comparison with your peers. You will simply not make it. And in a typical British understatement, Lennox called the exchange a remarkable situation. You know, both to his credit, to our benefit, John Lennox didn't follow that advice. Instead, since then, Lennox, who is an emeritus professor of mathematics at Oxford, has written dozens of books and engaged in countless debates arguing for the compatibility of faith and science, arguing that they aren't divorced, the reasonableness of theism and Christianity in particular. His debate partners include almost a veritable who's who of new atheism: Richard Dawkins, Michael Shermer, Lawrence Krauss, the late Christopher Hitchens, to name a few. He has his latest book, Here's the Question, that's the title: Can Science Explain Everything? And he makes the compelling case against what is known as scientism, or the ideology that insists that science is or should be the sole criteria by which the society should know what is true and good. And friends, I think it's important for us to recognize that this age of rationalism, of reason, that if people are approaching it from a legitimate standpoint, they have realized that it is lacking. And they say, where's the answers? And that's our job. We get to point to the compatibility between faith and reason, to the understanding that they are not divorced. But also, the resurrection is insignificant when I'm deceived. According to Festus, according to many people, Jesus was not unique. It almost hurts me a little bit when he says, in verse 19, rather they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead. And it's like, that's my Lord. And think about what you're saying. A certain Jesus who was dead. And it's like, you don't understand who you're talking about. Because this is no mere human. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse number 1 says, therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart. But we have renounced disgraceful and underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. But by the open statement of truth, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. You know, the resurrection appears to be insignificant when I'm deceived about who Jesus is. And it falls to us as a great joy to be able to share that with others. We get that joy of telling others about what Jesus has accomplished, about who he actually is, how he is the Son of God, veiled in flesh for a human time, but then liberated from his flesh in order to liberate us from our sin, or let me say that differently, liberated from his life in order to liberate us from our sin and provide us access to God so that we might live eternally with him. That's who Jesus is. So that's the first view. The resurrection is insignificant. Here's the second view. The resurrection is indispensable. First, I'd point out that the resurrection is remedial. It's remedial. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse number 13 says, but if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. We are even found to be misrepresenting God because we testify about God that he raised Christ, whom he did not raise, if it is true that the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. So Paul saw this clearly. His message was fixed upon this truth. Consider for a moment that great clarifying reality that will confront every person at the point of their death. How am I going to deal with my sin? Because that doesn't go away. Festus may solve the horns of his dilemma, where he says, I'm not sure which way to go, and he figures out I can get Paul over here, and it might solve his current problem, which is I don't want to make Caesar angry, I don't want to make the Jews angry, I don't want to kill an innocent man, although I'm probably most willing to do that. He's like, I want to solve all of that. But you know what he didn't solve? He didn't solve the question of, what am I going to do with the fact that I have sinned against a holy God? Well, that's sobering. And let us recognize that you and I have to have an answer for that. That the resurrection actually solves that problem and nothing else did. Let us tell others about the resurrection because they need to hear about God's solution for their sin. I think about what this means. That if I genuinely care about other people and I believe that this is genuinely the solution for their sin, then I must tell them about it, right? I have to share with them how important it is that the resurrection rises to that level of significance when I take into fact the reality that it solves sin's problem. The resurrection is remedial, it's also personal. In Acts chapter 17, verse 30, it says, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, all people, everywhere. Because he's fixed a day in which he would judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. You know, the resurrection is not merely a matter of private opinion. It's rather a fact that confronts every person. Every person, after death, will be raised to stand before the judge. It's so personal. It's also verifiable. It's also verifiable. I don't have time to prove this. I wish I did. Let me just give you two ways, and I can't go through all of the arguments, but let me just give you two ways, and there's many, right? But let me just give you two, the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances. I would argue that these are verifiable. That friend, if you come into contact with someone who struggles with the resurrection and they try to make the argument that it can't be proven, in any definition of what proving means, it's provable. It's provable. I genuinely believe that. It is entirely provable. That doesn't mean they'll believe it, but it's provable. It's something that is verifiable by any definition of what you would call verification. You say you compare the resurrection and the verification of the resurrection to anything else that could be verified, and it's just as verifiable. Do you believe that? Because it really is true. There's nothing to be ashamed of there. Nobody has a leg up on you. Nobody has a better understanding of it. Well, they might, but nobody has a true understanding that's better, right? Because the truth is that this happened. And all of history cries out that it occurred. You know, think about the empty tomb. That resurrection was preached in the same city that Jesus had been buried in shortly before. Nobody would have believed that this was true if the tomb wasn't empty. It was actually preached there. The Jewish arguments against Christianity admit an empty tomb. This is what you call hostile or positive evidence from a hostile source. And they say that it was true. The simplicity of the account shows that there's no legendary development that's occurring. The empty tomb was discovered empty by women, which in that day and age was considered worthless testimony. Why in the world would it happen in that way if it was a story that was concocted? If it was a story that was designed? Why? Because it actually happened. And you say, well, couldn't somebody have stolen the body? You know, those theories, actually, about the body being stolen are laughed at by serious scholars. You know, the Jews and the Romans had no motive to steal the body. They wanted to suppress Christianity, not encourage it, by providing an empty tomb. The disciples had no motive either. They're preaching the resurrection. And because of that, they were beaten, they were killed, they were persecuted. Why would they go through all of this for a deliberate lie? No serious scholar holds to any of those theories today. And you say, well, what explanation do they actually give. William Craig says this, quote, "They are self-confessedly without any explanation to offer. There is simply no plausible, natural explanation today to account for Jesus' tomb being empty. If we deny the resurrection of Jesus, we're left with an inexplicable mystery," end quote. The resurrection of Jesus is not just really the best explanation for the empty tomb, it's the only explanation. There isn't anything else. What about the resurrection appearances? There's three possible alternatives. They were lying, they hallucinated, or they really saw the risen Christ. And you begin to work through each of those, and you ask the question if they were all lying, and you begin to run into the challenges of how could they all maintain that lie with nobody cracking. You think about 10 people who would be willing to give their lives for a lie and maintain that, even if it cost them everything. What would they possibly gain? And after witnessing how quickly people turn and embrace different lies in our own world, it's so easy to recognize the absurdity of this. The hallucination theory is untenable because it doesn't explain the physical nature of the appearances. The disciples record eating and drinking with Jesus as well as touching them. This doesn't happen with hallucinations. It's highly unlikely that not only one person would hallucinate, but that they all would have the same hallucination. Hallucinations are highly individual. They're not group projections. And so this concept that they're all experiencing the same thing. Imagine if I came to you and I said, "Wasn't that a great dream that we had last night?" You'd be like, what? They don't transfer like that. And it can't explain the conversion of Paul 3 years later when he saw the risen Christ. You say, well, since the disciples could not have been lying or hallucinating, we have only one possible explanation. The disciples believed that they had really seen the risen Christ. You know, there are more evidences for the resurrection. These are just two. But they stand so solidly that there's no question. And what they do is they undergird the significance of the resurrection. Let me ask you that question. The question that faced Festus and Agrippa, that faced Paul, and faces you and me. Is the resurrection significant? Is the resurrection insignificant? Forgive the misspelling up there, right? Is the resurrection insignificant or indispensable? Think about your own life. What role does the resurrection play practically in your life? Is it something that motivates your witness for Jesus and how you shape the things that are important in your life today? Or is it something that you have relegated to an area of triviality, non-importance? And then, how can I get into the lives of others to challenge them about that same question? Father, I thank you for the time to look at your word and to recognize the importance of Jesus. And Lord, may we continue to just dwell and think about how significant the resurrection of your son was, how all that he accomplished by rising from the dead. And Lord, it's unbelievable it's really mind-boggling to try to wrap our minds around all of those aspects. And Father, we recognize that in that thinking, in that meditation, there is fertile fruit for motivation, for how we reach into others' lives, for confidence, for shaping our own lives so that we are seeking to live in such a way that brings glory and honor to you, in keeping our focus upon you in a way that distances us from the things that really are trivial. Father, I pray that you would just help us to recognize how we can embrace and allow the resurrection that happened 2,000 years ago to still be the major event in our personal lives. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.